China is unhappy about a House vote on import tariffs.
Are we headed for a trade war?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, September 30th. China today said a congressional move to punish it because of its undervalued currency could strain economic relations.
Also ahead, we should learn today whether the cost of a stamp will rise again. And Goldman Sachs is doing God's work, and God works in mysterious ways.
He does.
But first,
we begin with a global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. China says it will take its trade dispute with Washington to the World Trade Organization, the WTO. Beijing is protesting a bill that passed the House last night and heads over to the Senate. The debate, of course, centering around the claim that an artificially low Chinese currency makes their goods cheaper than American goods. Let's get a little perspective from Mark Chandler. He's a currency analyst at Brown Brothers Harriman, and he's with us from New York. Hi.
Morning. Thank you.
Does this have the potential to erupt into this big trade war?
I guess any little fight can always turn into a big trade war, but I think that you've got to keep these things in perspective. Canada is the U.S.'s biggest trading partner, and there's constantly tension between U.S. and Canada on various trade issues. So it's sort of like having a good neighbor. You might fight with them, but you're not going to go out and kill them.
Yeah, but Canada is just to our north. China's way across the world, right? And our biggest trading partner, right?
Actually, Canada is the biggest trading partner, but China has moved into second place. And I think that there's tensions there, but the tensions that Congress wants to focus on are about the currency. And what the Trade Representative's Office wants to focus on are bad trade practices, such as not protecting intellectual property rights, such as favoring Chinese companies from domestically. And so I think that there's a whole range of issues, and Congress wants to focus on the currency. And I think that my understanding would be that the Senate, it goes to the Senate now, but that the Senate, Chuck Schumer, New York senator, says that he's going to take up the bill after the election. So I think that one thing, for the next several weeks, it's probably not going to go any further than this. In addition to that, I think that even if it gets past the Senate, it's not clear that the Obama administration would sign off on it, especially if they believe that it would be in violation of the WTO. You know, the World Trade Organization, that treaty has a very high level of saliency in the U.S. in terms of the Constitution and the legal status.
All right. Mark Chandler at Brown Brothers Harriman, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And what does China have to say about all this? Here's Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz.
For all the vitriol spewed at it from Capitol Hill, China had a cool and collected response. A spokesman for China's Commerce Ministry shrugged off the vote, saying if the bill passed into law, it would breach the rules of the World Trade Organization.
Honestly, I think the Chinese ministry is right. I think it would be a violation.
Brian Mercurio is an expert on WTO law at Hong Kong University. He's one of several trade lawyers we spoke to who said the law would be a clear violation of WTO rules. Mercurio says the U.S. is in a tough position.
They could bring China to the WTO and claim a breach under the subsidies agreement, etc., or they could take their domestic action and then let China be the one who brings a case. I mean, I think there's risks to both strategies here.
And he's not even mentioning the risk of success. If the U.S. were to persuade the WTO to punish China for manipulating its currency, it wouldn't mean the renaissance of U.S. manufacturing, says Mercurio. It would just mean more cheap goods would start coming from places like Vietnam and Indonesia instead. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The Irish finance minister said today his country's public finances are, quote, horrendous. He made that claim while announcing how much a huge bank bailout in Ireland could cost. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us live from London to talk about the plan. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So the finance minister says horrendous. How bad is the Irish fiscal situation?
It's horrendous. He's right. Bailing out the Anglo-Irish bank and other lenders hit by Ireland's property crash could wind up costing the Irish taxpayers more than $60 billion, a very big sum for a small economy. The finance minister, Brian Lenehan, admits this could push Ireland's budget deficit this year to an astonishing 32% of GDP, 32%. But Lenehan says there's no alternative to the bailout. If, for example, a bank the size of Anglo-Irish went bust, it could bring down the whole Irish economy. Lenehan says that this bailout sum is huge, but he's confident it will work.
it is a manageable figure. And it does ensure that our banking system and the crisis in our banking system caused by reckless lending earlier in this decade is finally resolved and dealt with.
Now, Stephen, that optimism aside, the situation in Ireland is pretty bad. But how does it compare with the rest of Europe?
Well, the Irish deficit will be the worst in Europe this year, no doubt about that. But it's pretty clear other countries in the Eurozone are looking pretty sickly too. Moody's, the credit rating agency, downgraded Spain's government bonds today, down a notch from the top rating. Moody's cited Spain's low economic growth rate as a factor. And accountancy firm Ernst & Young has produced a gloomy report today on the Eurozone as a whole. It's predicting low growth and high unemployment. And it says, given the banking problems in countries like Ireland, it's still possible that a Eurozone country could default and that the single currency, the euro, could break up.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, September 30th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. BP's incoming chief executive, Bob Dudley, takes the helm tomorrow, and he's already shaking things up. He has ousted one top manager and announced a new safety czar. But it may take more than a change at the top to reform BP's culture. Reporter Janet Babin has that.
The most urgent item on Bob Dudley's agenda is to clean up BP's public image. He's created a whole new division dedicated to safety with the authority to intervene if standards are ignored. Amy Jaffe with Rice University says it's a good start, but she says managers at the top have to make it worthwhile for workers to put safety over productivity.
Put it into your compensation package that you get a compensation bonus based on your safety record. Other companies have done it through promotions. People who are competing for similar jobs, their safety record will be taken into account.
Others argue that BP needs to work from the bottom up. Jorge Piñon is a former BP executive now at Florida International University.
Boy, I can come out with a very fancy new organization and I can throw a lot of money at it and I can come up with the best manuals. It comes down to that individual. It comes to that operator.
But while BP figures out how to make this new safety culture stick, its competitors focus on expansion. Analyst Maddie Taitnin covers BP at research firm IHS Herald.
Their competitors don't have the same liability issues to deal with that BP does, so BP will be at an inherent disadvantage just from allocation of resources going forward, so that'll be a challenge it will have to overcome.
BP plans to sell $30 billion in assets to cover the cash needed to clean up the Gulf spill. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Welcome to the last day of the U.S. government's fiscal year. Overnight, Congress adjourned without passing a budget for the new year. Lawmakers did, however, extend current spending levels to keep the government running for the next couple of months. They're going to have to deal with the budget and taxes when they get back to Washington after the election. Another issue lawmakers will have to deal with in November, keeping the financially strapped U.S. Postal Service from going bankrupt. Government regulators today rejected the post office's request for a 2-cent increase in the price of a first-class stamp. It's going to remain at 44 cents. Marketplace's John Dimsdale is with us from Washington with the latest. Good morning, John.
Hello, Steve.
How did the post office justify this request for such a large increase?
The post office has been running deficits for 3 years running now, nearly $4 billion last year, another $7 billion this year. The service says that it's stuck with too many post offices and is forced to deliver lots of junk mail, even on Saturdays, to all sorts of out-of-the-way places for very little money.
All right. So why didn't the postal rate commissioners approve this rate hike?
There's a law that requires the post office to keep its prices within the rate of inflation, and this request exceeded that by a lot. And regulators say an increase just doesn't square with the decline in the volume of mail thanks to the internet and private deliveries.
And what's the reaction businesses, those businesses that rely on the Postal Service, what's their reaction?
Well, they were all smiles after this morning's announcement. A rate hike would have cost catalog companies and magazine distributors billions of extra dollars. But they're also sympathetic to the Postal Service's financial plight, since they do depend on the service. Jim O'Brien with the Mailers Council says the post office should look elsewhere for some relief.
The Postal Service actually has overfunded a civil service retirement account to the tune of $55 billion. So if this overpayment were reversed, the Postal Service would be in the black.
But Congress would have to give its permission to forego those payments, and there's a significant difference of opinion over whether the retirement account is really overfunded. Besides that, Congress, as you say, has now gone home to campaign for re-election, and this is just one of many issues that they're going to have to take up when they come back in the middle of November.
When they return. All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. John, thanks. Speaking of that budget that Congress didn't pass yesterday, a stimulus program that puts hundreds of thousands of unemployed people back to work, well, it's set to run out of money. Senate Republicans have blocked new stimulus money to keep the program going, so pink slips could start going out. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The stimulus money has covered part of the paycheck for people to work at private companies, nonprofits, and government offices. States and counties injected the money right into existing welfare-to-work and job training programs. Elizabeth Lauer-Bash is at the Center for Law and Social Policy.
Almost all of the money that went to this went directly into wages. There was very little overhead, so there was a lot of job creation.
250,000 jobs, everything from painting to pie making. Some of those jobs have turned into permanent positions. Without more federal money, most states will wind the program down, says Judy Conte of the National Employment Law Project.
It could have really brought tremendous returns for relatively modest investment, and it's a very sad, wasted opportunity.
Senate Republicans have blocked additional funding, citing the deficit, though the program has strong support from governors of both political parties. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
What do you think of when I say Basil? A cantankerous bed and breakfast proprietor in a British comedy? That's a fine answer. But if you said Basel III is a new set of international banking regulations, then I'm really impressed. Our friend David Brancaccio has been studying Basel III as part of a new marketplace beat. It's called Economy 4.0, and it's about the quest for a better financial system. Welcome, David.
Glad to be here.
So I know that world leaders are set to ratify the new Basel banking rules later this fall. I also know that bank rules are deathly boring, correct?
Au contraire. Actually, you know, there's a fascinating paradox for those of us who are not bankers for a living. On the one hand, Basel might avert the need for another bank bailout, always nice, yet the rules encourage stability by making banks hold on to more of their capital, which some worry could make them less likely to lend money to you and me.
How do these new rules work?
It's a way to force banks to have a thicker mattress stuffed with cash and other easy-to-access capital. Now, it's not good enough to have assets. They have to be more of the kind a bank can quickly use if a bunch of creditors show up wanting their money.
And how are those rules going over so far?
Well, I spoke with the experts about this, the great and the good, but some of the most useful wisdom I got was from a small businessman. Kelly Conklin runs a cabinet-making company in Jersey. These Basel folks adjusting capital reserves is all well and good, he says. But what about times like now, when lending is frustratingly tight?
I think we have to go back and think about the way banks think. They're going to have to change the way they think as well. They can't just adjust it mechanically. They're going to have to just adjust it somewhat philosophically. They're going to have the flexibility of mind at the bottom to see that the way out of the bottom is to make this credit available. It's not so much about reserves per se as it is about how you use those reserves.
In the U.S., the Federal Reserve controls this, so maybe flexibility will come that way.
David, I want to know, why do you care so much about this stuff?
Well, this new marketplace Economy 4.0 beat is about tracking efforts to re-engineer the financial system and to look at whether or not it can be made to better serve more people, like, for instance, Mr. Conklin, who we just heard from. Some say Basel is the biggest international response yet to how the banking system can be fixed. I think we should monitor these new rules of the road.
We'll be monitoring this stuff together. Marketplace's special correspondent, David Brancaccio. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, September 30th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. The future of a massive New York City apartment complex is a little clearer this week after a state appeals court ruled that a foreclosure sale will go forward. The $5.5 billion sale of the development 4 years ago marked the peak of the real estate bubble, but now the property is said to be worth less than half that. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village occupy 80 acres on the east side of Manhattan. Some 25,000 people live there.
And it's been a middle-class housing oasis, really, since 1947.
That's Al Doyle, president of the Tenants Association. Earlier this year, the owners of that oasis defaulted on billions of dollars in loans. Two groups of lenders have been battling for control. This week's court ruling clears the way for one of those groups to sell the complex. Economist Sam Shandon with Real Capital Analytics says the sale could be a bellwether for the recovering commercial real estate market.
A strong valuation, I think, could help to bolster what already is a positive underlying trend for the apartment sector in the United States.
Tenants are hoping for a deal that allows some of them to buy their apartments at affordable prices and others to stay on as renters. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Shares of Nintendo are down almost 10% in Japan today. The electronics giant has announced its much-anticipated 3DS handheld console. It's not going to be out in time for the holiday season. From London, here's the BBC's John Bithrie.
The 3DS is the first gaming device to offer the full 3D viewing experience, and you don't need special glasses. Nintendo wants the 3DS to be as successful as their Wii, but they've disappointed fans and investors alike by saying the device won't be ready in time for the holidays. Matt Martin from the website gamesindustry.biz says a pre-Christmas release would have boosted flagging console sales.
They've taken a hit like everything else, and I think this year in particular has been slow and there's been a decline. But yeah, I think the 3DS next year will be a kind of catalyst that will help boost the market and boost entertainment generally.
The computer gaming market is fiercely competitive, with Nintendo up against Sony and Microsoft, both of whom have launched enhancements to their gaming stations. But for Nintendo fans in the US waiting for the 3D handheld experience, they'll have to hang on until March. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
And finally, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein told an audience in Brussels the other day his investment bank is quite portable.
Yes, you know, it wasn't long ago Blankfein famously said his firm does God's work.
Yes, I remember.
The Financial Times reports Blankfein made it clear that if stricter financial regulations go into effect in a place like, say, Europe, then God's work can just move somewhere else.
In other words, the Lord giveth. And Lloyd Blankfein can take it away.
Yes, I think those are the words.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.